Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, a program where we talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. Good evening. I am thrilled and thankful for the opportunity to be coming to you from the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta, and to be in conversation this evening with one of my favorite authors, Bruce Feiler. He's among America's most preeminent thinkers, writers, and speakers about religion, spirituality, and meaningfulness in today's contemporary life. Bruce writes This Life column for the Sunday New York Times and is the author of 6 consecutive New York bestsellers, including Walking the Bible, Abraham, and The Secrets of Happy Families. He's also written and is presenter of the PBS series Walking the Bible and Sacred Journeys with Bruce Feiler. He's a real-life Indiana Jones, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In the first love story, Adam, Eve, and Us, Bruce Feiler claims that Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden have been misunderstood and blamed for bringing in sin, deceit, and death. But in his latest book, Bruce puts a different light on Adam and explains the many ways that we may have scapegoated Eve. While doing so, he elevates them to a place as role models for unity and forgiveness. Feiler shares his conversations about Adam and Eve with historians, archaeologists, psychotherapists, religious leaders, women's activists, and many, many, many more, gleaning their interpretations and perceptions. His journey takes us from the Garden of Eden in Iraq to the Sistine Chapel in Rome, from John Milton's Paradise Lost to Hollywood's Mae West playing Eve. Can you imagine that? Bruce and I first met right here on this stage over a decade ago to discuss Walking the Bible. And it was that conversation that really put the Holy Land on my bucket list. I was really, really anxious to visit after our conversation. And I'm proud to say, finally, I just got back from Israel. And it was really one of the most fascinating journeys I have ever had. So thank you, Bruce, and welcome to the show.
First of all, thank you for that generous introduction. I've checked and I'm still living. I too remember that incredible conversation that we had about Walking the Bible, as you say, on this stage, and the numerous conversations we've had since. I look forward to these. You know, I go off and do my travels and sit in a room by myself for the privilege of having conversations like this with people like you, and especially with you, and the voice and meaning that you hold in this city. So it's an honor for me to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, before we actually get into the love story, let's do a bit of a history review. Where is Eden geographically, and what did Adam and Eve mean in the ancient world?
So let's go, how about we go even further back, okay? So
okay.
I'm from Georgia, right? I grew up in Savannah. And when I think of myself and kind of the work that I have done, I'm interested in this connection between stories and place, right? Because when you come from places that are meaningful, and in Savannah, there's that stickiness and that familyness and that kind of sense of storytelling to kind of grow up in that incubator of the past, if you will. And I spent most of my adult life traveling around. I think of myself as two things. I think of myself as an experientialist. I like to go off into the world and have experiences. And I think of myself as an explainaholic, like go off and do something and then come back and explain what happened to me. And so I spent all of my 20s kind of traveling around. I wrote a book about Japan. I wrote a book about Oxford and Cambridge. I was a circus clown. And I would go and I would come back. The first place that I ever went where I felt like, you should think of myself as a bungee cord, like going and then bouncing back. The first place I ever went where I felt the bungee cord caught was in Israel. Okay, was this trip I took in the late 90s to Jerusalem, and I'm guessing on this trip that you just came back from, that you just alluded to, that you may have gone to this promenade overlooking the city, and a friend of mine was taking me there and said, that's the spot where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, you mean these are real places that you can touch and feel? What if I go on this journey and read the Bible along the way? So that was this initial impulse, now essentially 20 years ago. And from that moment, I wanted to go to the Garden of Eden, right? So the Bible says that the Garden of Eden is at the confluence of four rivers. Two of them, we don't know where they are. Two of them are the Tigris and Euphrates, and they meet today in southern Iraq. And at the time, in fact, the time I was walking the Bible, Saddam was in power, it was unsafe, I couldn't go. And so walking the Bible, there is this talking about the Garden of Eden, there's a scene in the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers up in Turkey, but I had never been to the confluence. We then changed that history, as we all know. We invaded, and suddenly Iraq was nominally under our control. And so in 2004, I made this journey, which was, I think, only stupid at the time, maybe not foolhardy, or maybe it was foolhardy and not idiotic or something. I mean, it was incredibly dangerous. I wore a flak jacket, I had security, and you go today to where the Tigris and Euphrates meet, and there is, in fact, a little garden. It's about the size of this stage. It's got three living olive trees and one dead olive tree, and it's covered in concrete. Okay, so Joni Mitchell was right. They paved paradise. Now, it's easy to imagine that this is where the Garden of Eden takes place. The problem is that Saddam diverted the rivers in the 1980s. So they've only met in this place for about 20 years. At the same time, so this is not the Garden of Eden, and this is not going to bring me any insight. Like, the whole conceit of walking the Bible was you could go and you could do topographical midrash, and you could learn something about the story by being in the place. Except all around where this is this watery terrain that's sort of like one part swamp, one part solid ground. You have, you know, palm trees and reeds poking up everywhere. And if you go back tonight and you open your Bible and you read the opening verses of Genesis, it talks about land emerging out of a watery chaos. And it's very clear that the people who were gathering these stories and telling them believed that this part of the world is the place they're trying to evoke in those stories.
So does that mean that we don't know where Eden is?
Where the Garden of Eden is has been a huge question. If you go back and look at the ancient world, when they thought the whole world revolved around the Mediterranean,
right,
they always put the Garden of Eden like at the top, like, or at the bottom, or at the, on the extreme edge, right? Because nobody had found it. And so what happened over the centuries is, as people discovered more land, they kept pushing the Garden of Eden kind of further and further out until, by the time of Columbus, he believed that he was going to see it. If you go back and you look at Columbus's journals, he talks about, on my way, I'm going to pass the Garden of Eden. Right. Well, turns out that wasn't Eden. And so then we discovered more of the world until the 19th century. Essentially, the only place that hadn't been explored at that point was certain places in the Pacific, so that when Darwin went to the Galapagos, okay, in the 1850s, Galapagos was meant to be, and as you know, I went to the Galapagos, and there's a whole chapter in my book about what Darwin and Adam and Eve can talk to each other. So the answer is, do we have an actual place on the map? No. Do we have a feeling that they're trying to evoke?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Adam and Eve.
Mm.
And I mentioned earlier, let's talk about the ancient and then how we are relating to them today.
Right.
So
for me, I'd spent all this time like on this journey of land, right? And that's really sort of the kind of core ideas of a lot of that work, is that, the Bible's the story about the nexus of God, the people, and the land, and we have to understand the land. Well, that was done 20 years ago. I was at a different point in my life. I was single, right? So now I'm married. I have identical twin daughters who soon will be 12. And so I live surrounded by women. And that means I spend a huge amount of time talking about the thing that is kind of baffling and confusing to us all, which is the changing ways in which men and women relate to each other, right? We have declining rates of marriage, increasing rates of divorce. We've got Lean In, Can We Have It All, The End of Men. And the internet's made this even more complicated. And as odd as it seems, we're in this kind of crisis. We live in this hyper-connected world, and yet we have this crisis of connection. So this journey begins a few years ago. We were on a business trip. My wife had a business trip to Rome. We take the girls, we tag along, and I'm the one who had the genius idea to take my sleep-deprived daughters on day one to the Vatican. Let's see some art. Let's get some culture. It did not go well, right? Oh my God, this is boring. My feet hurt. Why are there carpets on the wall? I mean, those are like the most famous tap. Why would people hang carpets on the wall, right? So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna get you into the Sistine Chapel, girls. I'm gonna blow your mind. So we get them into the Sistine Chapel, and I'm like, look up. So one of my girls looks at Adam and God sailing across the ceiling with the fingers almost touching and says, that's only men. Where am I in that picture? And then her sister, my mom in Savannah, is an art teacher, and she notices something I had never seen before, which is that under God's arm is a woman. And so she says, is that Eve? And I just had one of those moments like, oh my gosh, this story, one story, has been at the heart of every conversation about men, women, and sexuality for 3,000 years. And as crazy absurd as it sounds, maybe Adam and Eve have something to teach us today. Maybe the first relationship can tell us something about relationships today. So that's the initial impulse. But now let's go back to who I am. So I have this idea, but I'm an experientialist. What am I going to do? Like, there's no place to go. I've been to the Garden of Eden, and that story appears in my book, as you know. So what happens is I start pulling on these strings, and then I uncover this unbelievable story of how at every one of these moments of inflection in relationships, we've gone back to the story. So there's Michelangelo, you mentioned, John Milton, Mary Shelley in Frankenstein, Mark Twain, the most romantic writings about Adam and Eve, Ernest Hemingway, Bob Dylan, Beyonce, all the way up. So what I realize is I get to go on this unbelievable, like the ultimate Adam and Eve road trip, right? This incredible scavenger hunt, traveling around the world, encountering these stories. So it's not a journey of land, is really the story that I'm coming back to. It's a story of love. So what happens to me is I realize I'm writing a book about Adam and Eve. I go in to write a book about Adam and Eve, and I quickly discover that I'm actually writing a book about the history of love.
Well, which brings me to a question about Adam and Eve and love. Do you think that they were in love, or were they even aware of a concept as such, being that they were both just immediately made to be, and so they had no youth, no experience to look back on in terms of what love is? So did they love each other at that point?
Adam and Eve, kind of the first thing I discover is that Adam and Eve sort of introduced the idea of love. They are the first to grapple, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, with the central mystery of being alive, which is to be unalone. But as you say, it's not love the way we talk about love. And I think the problem is it's the way we talk about love. I think that what they do, and we're going to get into this, is love in its kind of messy, sticky, long-lasting, ups and downs, goods and bads, resilience, forgiveness kind of love, what it really means to be in love. But the way we talk about it, right, they can't dance to anybody else's love songs, right? I mean, everything about, it's almost the opposite. Normally people begin together and begin apart and come together. Well, they begin together and come apart, right? Normally people begin clothed and then get unclothed if they're lucky, right? Adam and Eve begin naked and then get clothed, right? So in a lot of ways, it's sort of the upside down of what a love relationship means. But I believe fundamentally, that it is a love story, but the problem is that history has dumped on them and made them scapegoats. So that I think that Adam and Eve, but let's be honest, especially Eve, are victims of the greatest character assassination the world has ever known, right? It's been death by sermon and conviction by midrash. Although I have to say, recently, I've just written that in a popular American newspaper, and the editor just wrote me last night, can you come up with another word beside midrash? I'm not sure our readers will understand midrash, okay? So I was like, okay, fine. So death by sermon and conviction by homily or whatever. So that really is the story. So I think that we have to separate the traditions that have been layered on top of them and go back to the original story And that, I absolutely believe, you can see what real love is.
So what is the point of that original story? In the book, you talk about aloneness, a disconnect or unconnected. So why, and in a way, that's really, I think, the first theme is loneness or aloneness. Talk about that a minute.
Well, first of all, of course, you're going right at what is most meaningful and spiritual and kind of mysterious and I think deep about the story. We live in a time of social science and positive psychology, right? The happiness movement. What's the number one thing we've been told by positive psychology is that relationships are central to well-being, okay? And I think of the Grant study, the Harvard study, 75 men, $25 million. Hundreds of men over 75 years. And the head of it said, this is what we learned. Happiness is love, full stop. So happiness is relationships. The antidote to that is loneliness. And that, I think, is really the social health crisis that we're in today. Young people being lonely, middle-aged men especially, like the opioid crisis, the suicide crisis, older people being lonely. What is the first thing that God says about human beings in the Bible? It's not right to be alone. Like, the Bible gets there 3,000 years before social science. So for those people today who say, oh, science has rendered the Bible moot, who needs it anymore? Here's a beautiful example where that's not true. For people who may be, you know, listening to us who think the Bible has all the wisdom, who needs modern science? Another example. To me, when you put the timeless wisdom of the past and the timely knowledge of the present in conversation with each other, then you get sparks and insight and depth and wisdom that I think is very valuable. But what I want to do is just quickly lay the ground here. So what you discover, first of all, is there's not one story about Adam and Eve. There are two, okay? So the second story is more famous in that, beginning in Genesis 2, you have Adam created from the earth, Eve being created from his body. It's not a rib, but we can get back to that in a second. Eve goes off and eats the fruit. It's not an apple. We can get to that. The two of them get kicked out of Eden. They don't. It doesn't end in failure. At that point, they come together. God blesses them with children. That doesn't work out very well. One of them murders the other, and then they reconcile and have a third child. That's the second story, and it appears to be about the way religion often talked about it, which is who's God's chosen sex, male or female? Like, you know, who's on top?
But when literally,
that comes up, you know, as you know, with Lilith. But when you look at the first story, it changes rather dramatically, because in the first story, God creates this ungendered human being and then divides it into male and female.
So now, this is the second Genesis story, or the first story.
It's the first
story.
Yeah, this is in Genesis 1.
This is the first Genesis.
Right, it's different from the second. So right. God creates God in Genesis 1 on the sixth day, so let's create humans in our image, and they create this kind of singular plural God, creates this singular plural creation that divides it into male and female. So what's true for the male is true for the female. They begin in total equality. It makes all that talk about who's superior totally different as you realize that it really is about a give and take and a kind of a seesawing of power, which any of us who've been in a relationship recognize as being, you know, completely how we live.
Right. You're listening to In Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, talking with author of six consecutive New York Times bestselling books, including Walking the Bible, Bruce Feiler, about his latest book, The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. We'll be back after this short break. This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation. This evening, with Bruce Feiler, one of America's most popular voices on contemporary life.
You already mentioned how we're facing a crisis, a mental crisis. Many of us alone are so very alone, in spite of all the social media, in spite of all of the organizations and so forth. But this, like you said, it's becoming a crisis, and it isn't just today, because 50 years ago, Martin Luther King wrote about how we were becoming alienated, even among ourselves and our own families and whatnot. And then Robert Putnam, you mentioned him, Bowling Alone in the book, one of my other favorite authors. He talks about how we had gotten to the point, and that's why it was called Bowling Alone, because we were out there doing stuff alone, you know, nowadays, and not with each other. And I found myself guilty of that. I looked at myself, I said, well, you know, you have, you know, you've gotten off of a lot of boards, you've stopped doing this, you've stopped doing that. Why? At first I said, well, maybe you just deserve it because you're retirement age. But then I thought a little bit deeper and I said, is that really what it is? So what do we do now with this loneliness that so many people are feeling? How can we apply the lessons from Adam and Eve then to our relationships today? What did we learn from Adam and Eve, or what should we have learned from Adam and Eve?
So let me take those in consecutive order. First of all, I think the story is fundamentally about the power and the need for human connection, and wherever you can find it. If you can find it, obviously in the story of Adam and Eve, it's the beginning of the biblical story. We got to get the story up and going. We need some procreation. We need some descendants. We have to get the story going. And yet, I think it's fundamentally about the importance of connection. Where does that phrase come in the story? It comes in the second story. So what happens is, in the second story, you've got Adam created from the earth.
The second story of
Adam and Eve in Genesis 2. And basically, the animals have been created, and Adam goes looking for a mate. He goes looking for a partner. He notices that the animals all have partners. So I think of it, God parades all the animals there before Adam. I think of it as this ultimate Tinder moment where he swipes left, swipe left, swipe left, you know, sort of, I don't want to be the rhinoceros. I don't want to be with the giraffe, but the rooster's not right for me. And then he kind of looks longingly up toward God, and God says it's not right for humans to be alone. And then he sets about creating Eve. And so what happens? You have the ultimate Hollywood meet cute. You have Adam being put to sleep, and he wakes up, and there's a woman next to him, right? And he's like, oh my, the first thing he says is, she's the one. He's just like, by the way, any guy. Like, he sets an eye on a pretty woman and he falls in love right away, right? You know, there's no getting to know you. There's no conversation. There's no meeting your parents. He's like, she's the one. And then what does he say? You're bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. I don't need to stand on the stage and explain bone, flesh. Like, he's very aroused, right? Let's get on with it. And then the story very clearly says the two of them were naked and no shame, right? So everybody's happy. It's like, what can go wrong? So in the beginning, it's very successful until the crisis that then emerges because she's not so happy and she goes wandering off into the garden. So I think that...
Why do you think she went wandering off into the garden?
Thank you all very much for coming. It's been a lovely night. Okay, so... let's step back a little bit and talk about what the commentator said. Okay, like the traditional story. So the traditional story is she's second class, she's second nature, she's second fiddle, okay? So for example, where is she formed from his body? In Hebrew, the word is selah. That word is used 38 times in the Hebrew Bible. It never means rib. It means side or side room. So the Bible's clearly suggesting that Adam and Eve stand side by side. But the commentators, what happened? Commentators get a hold of the story, and they're using it to dump on Eve. So they said that she's from the rib. Why? Because a rib is small and insignificant and given to putrefaction, just as women are small and insignificant and given to putrefaction. I mean, even if you know that, like, there was patriarchy at the time and that organized religion was won by men, it's shocking.
They were still very vicious. I was shocked at some of the
things. Oh, my gosh. You leave dirt out for 3 days. Adam's created from dirt. You leave dirt out for 3 days. It doesn't start to smell. You leave a rib out for 3 days, what happens? It starts to stink.
That's why women have to wear perfume.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Seriously. She wasn't created from the brain because she wasn't as smart, or the hand because she wasn't as helpful, right? She was created from the rib because it's the smallest, least important part of the body. I mean, on and on and on for century after century after century. I mean, so negatively branded was Eve, and it was very, very powerful. But now you get into, why does she wander off? Okay, and I have to say, I'm just sitting here looking, I had another one of these moments that you and I have been having these conversations off and on for 16 years. Since I've been talking about Adam and Eve, I've never gotten hate mail as I have gotten this time. I said on national TV last week, I was on back-to-back GMA and The View and Nightline and the NewsHour saying that they were in love. You should see my inbox. It will pop your eyes out by saying, by questioning what is it that motivated her, okay? So, and that she was equal. I mean, people are so invested in the negativity and the second-class nature of Eve that it's really startling and destabilizing. I have to guess it's mostly men, because when I say this to women, they seem to be desperate for this message. And that's in some ways the story that I tell, how Eve was kind of re-equalized over time. So what do we have? The Bible doesn't say. It looks like she's bored. She's not happy. She wants independence. Milton has a great version of this in Paradise Lost.
Absolutely.
Where she says to Adam, there's a lot of work to be done. This is a big old garden. And, you know, you're doing all the work by yourself. What do you say I help you? And Adam, in Milton's version, says, are you kidding? No wife of mine is going to be working around here. I'm going to do it all myself. And she says, well, you know, if I don't do anything, I'm just going to wander off in the garden and get into trouble. And he's, you know, debating about what to say. And he realizes, well, ultimately, she's got to have free will. She's got to have independence. So I'm going to have to let her go. And so she wanders off and she meets the fruit. So, but what is the fruit? The fruit is the fruit of the knowledge of it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Mm-hmm. So knowledge, like what she's looking for is knowledge for independence, for autonomy. I mean, as you know, there's a scene in my book where I talk to the professor who invented the idea of self-determination theory, like that you want to be intrinsically motivated for something. And he's reading. So like there's three different motivations. Like she could be viewing it for a negative motivation, right, that she feels like she's sort of enslaved to Adam, and that's not positive. She could do it to be spiteful. That's not positive. But it appears that she's doing it for self-oriented reasons. She wants the knowledge. She wants the power.
That's why she ate the apple. Why did Adam then eat the apple?
Okay, well, to me, this is a great moment, okay? So she eats the fruit, and then what does she do? By the way, she doesn't die.
Right.
So the internal logic of the story, there's a question there. And she's got, and in fact, Milton is also good on this. Milton says, oh man, this is good. I got the power now. This is a win for the female sex. I don't have to, but then she says, oh my gosh, so dear, I miss Adam. I don't want to do this without him. So she's got freedom, but she's got independence, but she wants interdependence. She wants a relationship too. She goes back to Adam. She gives it to Adam. Now he's got a dilemma. He knows what's right. He's been told, right? He's got duty or he's got love. He picks love.
He's afraid if he doesn't eat the apple, he won't.
He's
going
to be alone.
Anymore.
He's going to have to go back to where he was unhappy before. Mm-hmm. So he chooses. To me, this is the great love moment, mm-hmm, that they both choose each other. And let's be clear what happens. God kicks them out of Eden, but the last thing he does is wrap them in protective clothing. He needs them to succeed. Mm-hmm. His original commandment to them is be fruitful and multiply. He needs them to succeed. The question is, can they figure out a way in order to make it work?
Actually, there's very little sex discussed in the descriptions about Adam and Eve. Yet we've got Mae West playing Eve in a radio program that set people on fire. Talk about how Mae West could relate to Eve.
So here's what's interesting, okay? What's interesting is that Eve, time and again, is essentially the primary actor in the story. One woman I interviewed called it an Eviad, you know, like the Iliad. So she initiates the marital crisis, you know, on and on and on. She's the lead actor, except for the first 2,800 years of the story, women were not allowed to speak publicly about the story.
Excuse me?
For the first 2,800 years of this story, which is written down 3,000 years ago, women were not allowed to speak publicly about the story. The only interpreters that we had were men.
Males.
Okay,
correct.
So there were some men who were underlying this. Michelangelo has Eve, not Adam, not God, in the middle of the Sistine Chapel. It's not that image. The middle is not the one of the two fingers. It's the next image, the one of the creation of Eve. You've got Milton really building up this idea that it was a love story. But beginning in around 1900, women begin to speak about the story, and then everything we think about the story changes.
Especially when we bring in Lilith.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's just do a quick story before we get to Mae West. Let's start with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton in the 1840s in Seneca Falls, and I went to Seneca Falls, New York, in upstate New York, she and Susan B. Anthony essentially begin the women's rights movement. Stanton is the energy behind it. She's the brain. She's the writer, the thinker, the philosopher. But she's got seven kids and a husband in Congress who's never there. And when they are together, they're making more babies. So she's basically just overwhelmed. And Anthony is single. She's the public face. And she would call up Elizabeth. She'd say, oh, I got to give a speech. I need you to write me a speech. And Elizabeth would say, but I got all these kids. And so Susan said, well, I'll come over. I'll take care of the kids and stir the pudding and you write the speech. So the two of them, for 50 years, attack, you know, go after men's predominance, fight for women's rights in the voting booth, in divorce rights, in legal custody. You know, Stanton declares herself a candidate for Congress, the first woman ever to do this. What happens? Every time she says women should have rights under the law, somebody says, but the Bible says women are secondary. Women should have, you know, the right to own property. But the Bible says women are created second. So she realizes late in her life, after 50 years, that politicians are not her big problem. Preachers are. She's got to go back and rewrite the story of Adam and Eve. And she does. And late in her life, in her 70s, in 1895, she publishes a book called The Woman's Bible. Ultimately,
fascinating. I Googled it.
It's an amazing story. Who knows this story?
Check it out.
Valerie, yeah. I mean, you've been the pioneer. You've been at all these things. Who tells this story? The entire beginning of the book is about Adam and Eve, and it goes back to Genesis 1. And she says, look, they're created equal. They're true equal. All this stuff about his being superior is completely false.
This is the woman's Bible.
This is the woman's Bible in 1895.
That's a different story.
She's like one of the most famous women in America. Mm-hmm. This is not some dusty academic. The book is a success. The book is a landmark. It's a total disaster for her. The movement, the organization that she and Anthony founded, get together in Baltimore, hold an election, and kick her out of the group that she founded, okay? The reason that we know Susan B. Anthony today, that she's on the currency, and that far fewer people know Elizabeth Cady Stanton, is that she took on Adam and Eve, the most famous story in the world, and she got flattened.
For it.
40 years later, who's the most famous woman in the 1930s? Mae West, okay? She's like, I'm bigger than Picasso. In 1937, Variety said, Mae West is a hotter ticket than Hitler. She made more money than anybody. She's at the top of her powers. On December 12th, 1937, she goes on the number one radio show in America, the Chase and Sanborn Radio Hour, and she does a skit about Mae West. She does a skit about Adam and Eve. Mae West plays Eve. Don Ameche plays Adam. And I'm convinced, because he's the only person shorter than Mae West. Mae West was like 4'8". As you know, there's a scene in my book where I go to the place where they have the costume, right? And I stick my hand in her corset. A little bit of a thrill, I have to say. And they have her shoes. She's got these triple-decker shoes, okay? I mean, you're such a tall, elegant person. She had these shoes, and then a big, like, pole, and then this other shoe. And that's why she wore, skirts down to the ground. And by the way, why she walked and sashayed her hips, because if she lifted up her feet, she'd fall over, okay?
She had to slide.
She had to do that slide that she's famous for, right? Okay, so, and I saw the shoes, you can see them. Okay, so Mae West is Eve, Don Ameche is Adam, and the snake is played by the soon-to-be most famous person in Hollywood, Charlie McCarthy.
Yes, that's right.
Are you happy to see me, or is that a wooden nose? I mean, these are actual lines from this skit. Now, so he gets through. You brought up sex, Valerie. You can't be embarrassed. You took us there, okay? So, all of these words, I mean, Mae West, all the words got through the censors, but she totally sex pots it up.
Really?
Adam, I'm so bored. We're just sitting around here playing. I'm bored right down to my marriage certificate. We're just sitting around here playing solitaire.
I want some action.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so he's like, he's like the Chamber of Commerce. It's so wonderful. The weather's lovely. There's plenty to eat, right? And she's like, I'm bored. So she wanders off. She eats the fruit. It's an apple in this version. She says, well, and the snake says, well, how are you going to feed this to Adam? And she says, well, I'm going to make it into applesauce, which I have no, I really, I mean, to be honest, I actually have heard the original. I don't get the joke, but anyway, she goes back, she feeds the applesauce to Adam, thunder, lightning, and he's horrified. And of course, Mae West is ecstatic. Like, oh my gosh, this is wonderful. I just made a little history. I got the big fat first original kiss. Okay. Now, so this happens on December 12th, 1937. And what happens next today this is great that we're telling this story on the radio. Today is predictable, but at the time was shocking. There's a huge, organized letter-writing campaign. Right. They write the White House. They write Congress. They write NBC. Mae West has ruined my virginal daughter's ears. I mean, like, to read the letters, and it becomes such a scandal that Mae West, the biggest actress in Hollywood at the time, is banned from radio for life. For the second time in 50 years, the most famous woman in America has taken on Adam and Eve and gotten flattened. It's unbelievable. It wasn't until the second wave of feminism in the 1960s that women and men together really were able to reclaim the story. I think of Phyllis Trible, the great, one of the first kind of feminist Bible scholars, who loved to ask her students, so why do you think Adam was superior? And the students all said, why do you think? Because Adam was created first. And then, so Phyllis Trible would say, but you know, in the Bible, the animals are created first, but they're not superior because right. In the story, in the Bible, what's last is often best. Think of Shabbat, you know, think of the seventh day.
What's last is often first.
Yeah, what's last is often first. So Eve was not an afterthought, she's the culmination. So today, when men and women stand equally before God, we owe that to Adam and Eve.
What happens after they leave Eden? You don't really hear very much about that.
Right, and even the commentaries don't discuss it, but to me it's the most interesting part of the story. So what happens? First of all, they could part. They could, you know, we're done. It didn't work.
You go your way,
Right, we know that. But they don't. They stay together. They forgive each other, and they have children. And I don't have to tell anybody like you who has children, and anybody listening to us has children, but there's a lot of research that confirms this. Having children is difficult on a relationship, right? It's not all, you know, it's not all balloons and birthday cake, right? It can be a challenge. And of course, the Bible gets that right too. The first family is a dysfunctional family. Now, it's not the Thanksgiving dysfunctional family. It's a, you know, murderous fratricide dysfunctional family. But they get this right. Now what? One of their children is a murderer. One of their children is dead. Cain murders Abel. Cain gets cast out. Yet again, we're at a moment that the story could stop dead in its tracks. And in fact, if you look at the text in Genesis 4, we are now, and in all the commentaries, it says there's this moment of separation. But what happens?
We'll be right back after this short break and continue our conversation with Bruce Feiler, PBS host and writer for the series Sacred Journeys and Walking the Bible. Welcome back to In Conversation. I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Joining me at the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta is best-selling author Bruce Feiler, talking about his latest book, The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us.
We need to talk about that definition of love.
Yeah, I knew you were going to come back to that, Valerie. Yeah. I think we're going to let that just slide.
So let's do that, because, you know, there are some theories out there, even in your book, that love is beginning to replace the divine that used to be between us and God and each other, even that it's become commercialized, if you will. So let's talk about love and the definitions today and which ones you think we can still use.
So as I said earlier, in writing this book, it's called The First Love Story. I went in to write a book about Adam and Eve, and I quickly discovered that I was writing a book about love. And love has also changed over time. And it used to be something that was a gift from the gods, and then kind of human beings and God were co-creating. And now love is kind of mostly seen as something that we create ourselves, and that God's a little bit been pushed out of it. So yes, I did talk to a philosopher who said that basically love has replaced God as the kind of the highest thing that we can connect with. To me, I'm not prepared to go that far. I know a lot of people who care about God and who care about love too, and I think that the two can coexist. But I think that the larger point here is that love has been glorified and elevated in our culture to a very, very high place. But the problem, I think, is that we're calling the wrong thing love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have this idea of this kind of Hollywood version of love, that you meet and you fall in love and you make a choice and you live happily ever after. Well, anybody who's been in a relationship more than, I don't know, 3 months realizes that that doesn't work, right? That love is not a choice that you make once. Love is a choice you make multiple times. You make over right. and over and over right. again. Right. And so we define love as the tingles and something like it's effervescent, and then when it evaporates, we're surprised, right? You know, we describe it as something that's kind of transient, and when it goes away, we're upset. But you can't take time out of love. Like, you need time in. So here's what I've come to think about love. To me, of all, and I read a lot of books about love, and obviously a lot about Adam and Eve, and the best definition that I've come up with is that love is a story we tell with another person. It's co-creation through co-narration. And it's the co that really matters, right? I mean, your kids are grown now, and my kids are adolescent. But when you have young kids, you know, they get together in a room, and they appear to be playing together, but they're really just talking to themselves, right? Piaget, the great Swiss psychologist, called this collective monologue, mm-hmm. right? That's what child's play is like. Well, love is the opposite. It's collective dialogue. And it's something that you're doing together. You have your story, I have my story, but then we come together to tell our story. And that's the significance of Adam and Eve, right? Think of any other figure in the Bible. Noah, Abraham, Moses, David, on down the line, Jesus, Paul. They're all singles. Even the one who were in relationships are singles. Adam and Eve are the only ones that are a couple. Not Adam, not Eve, Adam and Eve. Right?
And we always say Adam and Eve.
We always say Adam and Eve.
Very seldom do you ever hear...
One or the other. It's like theirs is the first joint byline. And that's the thing that's most important. And by the way, to go back to the archaeology where we started, this is a breakthrough in thought. In all the other stories in the ancient world, back to Mesopotamia and Egypt, there was a god and a god create humans, or a god and a human create humans. The Bible is the first document to have a man and a woman at the start of the human line. You have a single god giving the power of creation to man and woman in this case, and saying, go figure it out. You guys work it out. So God wants and needs them to succeed. And it's the fact that they keep doing it, keep making that choice, keep figuring out how to get back together, even in the face of unimaginable pain, mm-hmm. that's their greatest contribution.
You mentioned 6 elements of romantic love
yes.
that you've identified. Can you quickly go through them? I'm going to just quickly run them off. And then
yeah.
you covenant, connectedness, counterbalance, constancy,
care
yep. and co-narration.
Yeah, so to me, this is the kind of what I learned. And most of them are positive, and there's one negative. So covenant is an old-fashioned word
yeah.
that I've kind of brought back into this conversation because relationships have become commodified today, right? We've got, you know, Real Housewives and, you know,
yeah.
you've got reality television and tabloids and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of like something like that's disposable. So I think to remember that this is a calling, that it's a sacred thing, that it's a meaningful thing, that certainly I'd like to look my daughters in the eye and say that this really matters. Like, take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And in this hookup culture that we have. So yes, covenant is number one. Number two is connectedness. Back to this idea that it's all that in this hyper-connected world, we have a crisis of connection. That's what I want to say about connectedness. Get your eyes off the screen, mm-hmm. walk out the door, make mm-hmm. eye contact with someone, mm-hmm. talk to somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, have a human connection. That's what this story is fundamentally about. What's next? Constancy?
Counterbalance.
Counterbalance. So counterbalance, I think, is really important, right? It's this mix of independence and interdependence, right? You know, sort of Eve is created from Adam's body, but Adam clings to her. Adam initiates the lovemaking, since you wanted to talk about sex so much, Valerie. Adam initiates the lovemaking, but Eve gives them their name, and the naming is the power. So they both are, they're independent, but interdependent, right? I think of that Cahil Gibran quote, right? Love is the antidote to loneliness, as long as there's aloneness within it. So you need mm-hmm. to be yourself mm-hmm. in order to be in a healthy relationship. So then you got constancy.
Wait a minute. I want to say something about counterbalance,
yeah.
though. You mentioned that you don't necessarily need equality.
Oh, yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
You know, but that you need balance.
Well, I talked to Helen Fisher, who's this great anthropologist of love, and she says, we talk a lot about equality, and that's not really what we're mm-hmm. after. Mm-hmm. Because equality is equality, and, you know, but she said, in any relationship, one person is better, you know, with the kitchen, one person's better in the garden, one person's better with the, with, you know, taking care of the house or the finances. And as we all know at this point, those roles have nothing to do with gender, right? It just, who has the natural inclination.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so she's like, you don't want equality, you want equilibrium.
Right.
So that each person feels in balance, feels like they have autonomy, but they also have self-sacrifice. Or to be a little blunter, you want to be selfless, but also a bit selfish at the same time.
So, okay, good. Constancy.
Yeah, constancy to me is the resilience. It's like you keep coming back at it. And they do. They start together. They separate. They come back together. They get kicked out of Eden. They come back together. And, they lose a child. It's a very powerful
story. And that's commitment,
too.
It's commitment, which I think we don't see a lot of today. You know, that was
Well, these are not the stories that we herald. Back to my point. Right, this is
right.
not what we call love.
Right.
We don't
right.
call love the 20-year slog, or maybe there was a period of difficulty, or maybe you know, one lost a parent, or got sick, or lost a job, and they managed to work it out. It's not all rose petals and champagne.
But they hang
glasses.
In there, as Adam and Eve did. They keep coming back, and they keep trying.
And that's what love is. That's
mm-hmm.
what love is.
Right.
It's that thing. You don't put the novel down after the second chapter. You get to the end, and it's going to have conflict in it.
Constancy, and by the way, you mentioned Shakespeare, Sonnet 116, my all-time favorite.
Oh, yeah,
all-time
because it's like
favorite.
You stick it out to
love
the edge.
Love is not love that alters when alteration finds. No, it is an ever-fixed mark. Ah.
And you stick it out to the edge of doom. And by the way,
the
who knows the edge of doom better than Adam and Eve?
Hello. Okay, good. So constancy, care.
Well, care, I have to say, is a negative example because I'm convinced you asked me at the outset of this conversation, are Adam and Eve in love? Yes, Adam and Eve are in love. I have to say I proved it much more than I expected when I started. So I think they love each other. But do they like each other? I mean, that we're missing, you know, kind of the nicknames, like the cooing, like the sweet nothings. It would be nice to have a little tenderness. There's not a lot of tenderness.
Well, they didn't have any role models.
Well, exactly. They didn't have any. And when they got into trouble, by the way, no couples therapists, right? You know, no escapist TV, right? So there was nothing they could do. So, yes, I wish it was a little, but that's not how they thought about it.
Yeah.
Maybe, but I wish there was some tenderness.
But sometimes care is more important than.
Yeah.
More important than affection.
I think that's right. And I think that, care. I do think caring for each other.
And that brings us to co-narration.
Well, and that's what I talked about this before. Ultimately, it's an act of storytelling. And that is the great, powerful thing. And back to Helen Fisher, the anthropologist, she said to me, she's put couples that were married for a long time in the brain scans. And you can see that different parts of the brain light up. And it's the part of the brain that's about forgiveness or maybe kind of looking the other way or tolerating, right? You know, it's like you just need to hang on enough to have a story that you tell together. Mm-hmm. So this idea of co-narration, it's something that you build over time. And I have to say, this is the thing, since I've been talking about this book, that comes at me most in the tweets and the emails, in addition to the hate mail, the love mail that I get, is about this idea, is to think of love as storytelling and to think of a relationship as sort of the act of perpetually revising your own love story. So you're in the love story and you're constantly revising it, you know?
Talk about falling in love as opposed to standing
in love. Well, that's the thing, falling in love, again, in the language that we talk about, falling in love is very passive, right? Like you're walking along and then you think about the language that we use. You get hit by lightning, all right? You get a punch to the gut, or you fall in love. There's no
control.
There's no act. There's no agency in that. Whereas standing is hard. Trust me, as somebody who had, who was a cancer survivor and had to rebuild my leg and who spent, thousands of hours in the last 8 years relearning how to walk. It's hard. I mean, every step is an accident waiting to happen. Standing is hard. Mm-hmm. And it was Eric Fromm who said that falling in love is easy and standing in love is hard. And I have to say, when I was hired by CNN to cover the Pope when the Pope Francis was here in 2015, and we were in Philadelphia. There was a million people out there, and he had this beautiful, they give to the press, as advanced remarks, and they gave us his remarks, and it was this incredible, beautiful reading of Adam and Eve, like I had been putting together for years, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is awesome. He's about to validate my theory. But it was late, actually, and speaking of standing and falling, his sciatica was acting up, and so he kind of like dragged himself to the point. He'd been up all day, the guy's in his 80s, and he scraps the speech because he thinks nobody wants, I felt like saying, I'd like to hear the speech, would you please give the speech, thank you very much. He gives this extemporaneous talk about love. And he quotes this, he quotes Eric Fromm, who's just beautiful on the topic of love as something that's important and meaningful. And by the way, sometimes even stronger the second time around.
So how do we not succumb to hate? How do we cultivate love, and how do we bring it back if we lose it?
This is interesting, I have to say, for me personally, because when I was working on this book last year, you know, like everybody else, I expected to be publishing this book into the environment where we were going to have the first female president. It was going to kind of look like a kind of you know, Eve redemption story. And now the country has obviously moved in a different direction. And yet what's happened is the actual kind of bonds of our culture at times have seemed to be fraying. And there is this kind of feeling where people feel this disconnection. And this is something that people talk about. So to me, publishing the first love story now is just different. And yet it also has this deep resonance about, so I think that, you know, the first thing I would say is what I was saying to my earlier about stop looking on your screen into this kind of sheltered, narrow world where you can kind of pick the news and people that you hang out with, walk outside, make eye contact, have a conversation with a friend, a neighbor, someone with whom you might disagree. That just seems very essential. But what I, why I think all this matters, at least to me, Valerie, you know, we're in this interesting moment where nothing was more discriminatory against women than organized religion. And yet exactly at the moment religion has become voluntary, women have stuck around and they're kind of propping up religion. Religion, women care more, are involved more, pass on values to their children. Women are basically keeping it alive. And they weren't going to do it without finding in this story their own lives. And, and those of us who are in conversations about men and women all the time can go back now and see ourselves in this story. And the thing is, it's a success, and it matters that our foundation, this story has been about whether you believe the story or not, this story has been at the foundation of our civilization for 30 centuries, okay? Yeah, that's 100 generations, and it matters that it be a success, and it is a success, and to me, that flips the switch and says our default with relationships is that they can work. That's why I can look my daughters in the eye now and say it's not just promised land in the Bible, it's promised love, too.
All right. Bruce Feiler, you did not disappoint. Your humor, insight, and wisdom in The First Love Story has captured our imaginations and renewed our faith in our abilities to be strong, resilient, and empowered by love. Thank you so much for such an inspiring conversation this evening.
Thank you. Thank you for being with me and for sharing your love with so many, Valerie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our website at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Thank you to the Marcus Jewish Community Center of Atlanta for hosting today's program event. The producer for this show is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Christine Dempsey, Lois Reitzes, and Dave Burswain. Until next time, join me, Valerie Jackson, in conversation. Take care.